Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, the worst, the weirdest, the wildest, and everything between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, drawing the line right here.
Okay, and this week's awesome conundrum, Star Trek's most iconic moments, part one.
Part one. Yeah, Cam, you and I, we decided to do this, and then I think you and I were texting each other the other night, and we realized we both got up to about 50 iconic moments. And
that was really just the shallow end of the pool.
I did zero research. This is all just off the top of my head.
Yes.
And so I was just like, Cam, why don't we be so bold as to call this Star Trek's most iconic moments, part one.
Yeah, I think the idea of what this episode would be kind of changed from pitch to where we're sitting now.
Yeah.
I think would be more fun is kind of the idea of Subspace Transmissions kind of putting together its own sort of hall of fame for Star Trek iconic moments. And we're going to, you know, bring in a whole slew of them tonight. And hopefully we'll do that in the future. And we'll kind of maybe put together the ultimate catalog of Star Trek iconic moments over however many episodes this takes us.
Essentially, if you listeners want to know if Cam and I have fallen behind on our research for other episodes, we'll be falling back on this as like our go-to last-minute sort of episode. It's going to be fun, though, as we go through parts, you know, 2 through 17 eventually.
It'll be like Roman numeral volumes too, just to make it look extra pretentious.
Yes, but you know, let's get started. I think it's a very self-explanatory sort of conundrum that we've got, but I just want to get going, and I'll give you an example of what I'm going to play here. We might get a little bit kind of multimedia for some of these iconic moments, but I'll start off strong. I think this is a very iconic moment in Star Trek, so listeners, you feel free to disagree or agree with us, or send us some of your suggestions for iconic moments. But
I can't wait to hear this Voyager clip you're gonna play.
Get the cheese to sick bay.
I will not sacrifice the Enterprise. We've made too many compromises already, too many retreats. They invade our space and we fall back. They assimilate entire worlds and we fall back. Not again. The line must be drawn here. This far, no farther.
Cam, I know First Contact, you have it more of a middling film,
yes,
correct?
Yes,
but
I
think this has to be, regardless of what you think of the film, one of Star Trek's most iconic moments, if only because of the...
I wildly disagree. No, I completely agree.
And I think it has to do a lot with the marketing for this film. That particular scene was front and center in all the marketing.
Really? I thought it was the assimilate this.
Oh, yeah, that was... Well, no,
that's,
you know,
that's the one I remember more as being kind of a non-fan at that point. That's the one I remember from the trailers.
That was more of... I don't know if it was from the trailers so much as the TV spots.
Well, that actually, yeah, that's
I
what
think
I
it was
seen.
From the TV spots, but right. This one was in the trailers, and I think this one has endured so much, and I think Patrick Stewart is on fire mm-hmm. as he's talking about what he's willing to do or not do with regards to fighting the Borg. He's got such a great dancing partner there with Alfre Woodard as well. Cam, despite what you may feel about Star Trek First Contact, it's personally my favorite Star Trek film.
Yeah.
Would you put this as one of Star Trek's most iconic moments?
This is definitely one of Picard's great speeches. It's refreshing that, you know, after 7 seasons, 26 episodes a season of TNG, when they got to those movies, as shaky as those movies were, in my opinion, they still had iconic moments to spare, because you can imagine after that many episodes with those characters getting to movies and just being like, we just kind of repeating the same old stories and not bringing a whole lot new, you know, giving Picard a monologue that memorable, you know, that long into the character's growth, I think it really speaks well to what they brought to that movie.
It was just so much buildup leading up to that point. Cause if you recall just moments earlier, Picard and Worf have seen, it was their biggest, you know, throwdown ever, essentially, where Worf says, if you were any other man, I'd kill you where you stand.
Right.
You know, Picard's calling him a coward, and it's all building up to this moment here with when Lily Sloan confronts him about this. And
right.
To me, I think the fact that I think a lot of non-fans would actually remember this, if only from the, you know, trailers 20 years ago.
I've always been curious how outsiders of the, you know, non-fans of the franchise view Picard. Because to me, Picard is sort of a character that you really get to love and adore based on watching the series, like watching that character beginning to end. Like, I think Kirk has more punch as a standalone character.
Sure.
And I've always just been fascinated by how Picard is perceived, that, you know, just to non-fans.
Yeah, well, because there's two different Picards. There's the Picard from the TV series, yeah, and then there's the action hero Picard that Patrick Stewart mandated they have throughout the film series.
Like, a lot of people would have only seen Picard in the movies. Like, what impact does that speech have on them?
Yeah.
I really don't know.
Well, you know, I think Patrick Stewart, he carries it. And I think Jonathan Frakes said that it took him like 3 days to do that one scene. Like, they took their time on that. So right. Props to them. Cam, and this is an example here. We're talking about Star Trek's most iconic moments. As we go through this, they're not going to necessarily be the best moments.
Right.
You know, it's just stuff that people are going to recognize. Maybe, and by people, we should define them. Some of these moments, fans are
right.
going to call them most iconic, whereas mainstream people wouldn't necessarily know. Other moments, it's going to be, you know, mainstream will totally recognize this. But why don't you take it away, sir? What's first on this list here?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, like, just jumping off of what you said, like, these are the moments when you see a photo, say, online, you know, like, you know that moment. You know, there's a feeling attached to that moment. Like, it speaks volumes, you know. Like, if I show you a random shot of Chakotay in a chair, it means nothing to you.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I show you
Q in a sombrero,
that means something.
Yeah.
It's iconic. It's instantly evokes memories of the show, and it has a certain, you know, legacy attached to it.
Yeah.
So that's really the moments we're talking about to kind of define it. So I'm actually going to take it right back to the pretty much the start of the franchise.
Boom.
In a moment I wanted to reference, which is Vina in the green Orion makeup dancing in front of Pike.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Green. Almost like secret dreams a bored ship captain might have.
You know, that image of that dancing green Vina would ultimately have a huge impact on Star Trek going forward, more so than the Talosians ever would. As iconic as the Talosians are, it's green. It's a Vina in the green makeup, or Greena, as I like to call her.
Wow, that's clever.
Look, I'm making the most of a slip of the tongue.
Did your dad tell you that joke?
No. It's pretty good, though, right?
Sure.
But
for a dad joke. Greena. You should be ashamed of yourself, Cam.
I didn't even mean to say it. I was rolling with it.
Anyway, go on.
But no, like, that image, you know, has so much power and ultimately would, you know, lead to the Orion characters on the show, and they would always be trying to recapture that glory of that moment.
So, Cam, I forget if we told listeners at the start of this, but you and I, we each possess veto power that we're able to use once per episode. I will not be using my veto power on this.
So good. I was like, Greena is safe.
Because the reason I know this is such an iconic moment is, well, as a kid, like, they made reference to it on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Oh, okay.
And as a kid, before I was even watching, like, the original series, like, I got the reference. Like, it was so pervasive. Like, everybody knew that green Vina from Star Trek. But I always associated her with, you know, trying to lure, like, Kirk.
Right.
Not, you know, Captain Pike. I had no idea who Captain Pike was back
right.
in the day.
There. And what's fascinating about this particular moment is that, look, we've seen the cage. We think it's fantastic. And, we the cage wasn't seen until 1986.
Right.
Oh, you know? And what they would have seen was the menagerie.
Yeah.
But the fact that this single moment from the episode The Menagerie impacted people so hugely is really interesting to me.
How much is it that versus the fact that she's featured quite prominently in the end credits?
Also quite true.
I think that's a big factor in there as well. I wouldn't say that I knew her from the end credits. I think what I knew Vina from is whenever I'd see, like, these retrospectives on Star Trek, that clip was always played.
Yeah.
So that's how I would totally go there. She makes it into the most iconic moments list for me here.
Of course.
Okay, Cam. So I've, you know, why don't we stick with TOS this is one that we have to mention as well. I don't need to play a clip because I think it's pretty self-explanatory, but what happens when Kirk goes up to a compartment and opens up a compartment and Tribbles fall all over him?
This is on my list, too. Yeah. I mean, don't you find, though, like, TOS is an embarrassment of iconic moments? Because the show has had 50 years for, like, clips and shots, you know, just to be repeated over and over, to be ingrained into your memory. Like, there's so many ingrained. That's actually a pretty good Tribble joke.
Wow. You're on a roll, Mr. Dad joke. Go on.
But, you know, there's. I just found, like, I could make a list of hundreds of TOS moments, you know, and they would all be deserving. But this one is near the top of the list. Having, you know, Kirk, in that pile.
Do you think it's near the top or at the top? I think it might be number one.
I think for the normies, it's at the top.
Yeah, for the normies, yes. Yeah. I think this would be number one among iconic moments for Star Trek.
I have one that I might hold higher. Okay. But there's actually a couple I might hold higher. But this is...
but you're not a normie.
I'm not a normie. So
you're not vanilla.
No, no. Well, my jokes are, but...
Case in point. case in point.
But, you know, I totally agree. I mean, Trouble with Tribbles is... I think the perfect entry episode also for non-fans. So while I don't think, you know, non-fans would watch, say, the Enterprise incident, be like, man, that was a fantastic hour of television, as good as it is, the Trouble with Tribbles is easily digestible, like that grain.
I don't know if listeners, if I can really describe how far I'm rolling my eyes into the back of my head at this point.
Oh boy. No, but you know, it's an episode that is easily consumable to anyone and very enjoyable. And I mean, again, that moment is so great. I mean, so good that of course they're bringing it back in DS9.
Oh yeah.
You know, and paying homage to it. So yeah, I mean, this is one of the big ones.
Boom. Okay, it's locked in. Cam, what's next on your list here?
Well, speaking of episodes that, you know, are beloved by fans, let's talk about Broken Bow.
Okay.
And let's talk about Decon Gel.
Okay, Cam, can you stop right there? Because this is on my list as well. And just listen to this. That's the sound of people putting Decon Gel on themselves. Like, yes, I'm so glad that this is on your list. Okay, go
I
for
found
it.
Enterprise very difficult to find iconic moments for because so much of Enterprise is about showing moments, you know, kind of homaging moments from the rest of the series. And also at this point in Star Trek's run, the popularity had dwindled so much that the shots just don't have the impact that the other series necessarily do. Like, I found it kind of a sliding scale as we got from each series in, you know, they kind of dropped with each one.
Sliding like you'd slide Decon Gel.
Yes. But this moment, this Decon Gel moment, is so iconic. Like, it might be the most lasting image to come out of Enterprise, which...
Cam, it's first on my list for Enterprise. I don't know how anything even comes close. I've got other Enterprise, you know, moments here.
I have another one, too, and it's nowhere near in this category.
No.
This Decon Gel scene was advertised heavily by Entertainment Weekly, I remember, in, like, publicizing Enterprise before it aired.
Trojan...
Yeah, it was on TV. What? Wait, what?
No, I was joking. I like how you're like, yep. Go on.
But also, you know, TV, they're showing clips of it. Like, this was Enterprise saying, this is what we have to offer. This is what differentiates us from all of their series is Decon Gel.
It ain't your daddy's Star Trek.
Goes down smooth.
But... okay. But among fans, though, if you ask any of the fans that we meet at the conventions, just name a scene from Enterprise, they're going to go with Decon Gel. Like, this is the go-to scene.
It is. And as goofy as it is, as much fun as we all make of it, I mean, even the show, at a certain point, appears to be making fun of it. Because you have, like, that moment where it's, like, Archer sitting there with, like, Hoshi and T'Pol holding Porthos.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's, like, it's the show at a certain point seems to think it's ridiculous, too. Well, I don't really know. I never quite could wrap my head around if they ever truly recognized what a joke it was.
Well, you and I think we pitched this idea a couple months ago about how come there was never a Shran and Phlox decon gel scene.
Yeah. Like, that's when you know that they're in on the joke.
Yeah, yeah.
But maybe they never want to give that away completely.
Okay.
But no, I mean, decon gel, yeah, it's in.
Is decon gel still around by Star Trek Discovery? It still takes place 10 years before the original series came. There could be decon gel.
Well, here's the question, talking about decon gel. Like, decon gel had a purpose.
Sure.
What did they do going forward? Because there was never references to, you know, potential contamination or anything like that. Like, did the transporters remove this stuff in the future?
Yeah, I that's my guess.
Is that what it is?
And I guess, like, the airlocks probably have some mechanism that... Or you get inoculations or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Medical science.
Do you think they'll touch on that in Discovery?
Oh, yeah. Touch on that gel. Rub it all over.
Okay, well, let's get to your next one.
I just want to talk about decon gel.
And
anymore.
I'm not vetoing...
All right. Well, you know what? Here's another one. Keep it on like some of the other series that maybe don't get as much play, you know, but this is one that I don't know how people don't know this, especially when it comes to my favorite Star Trek series.
It's a fake.
In the Pale Moonlight, one of the most iconic episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, period.
Yeah.
But this scene where Senator Vrenak says to Benjamin, after he discovers the isolinear rod is like a fake isolinear rod, very iconic. Is it not, sir?
Yeah. I mean, I had another moment from that particular episode.
More iconic than it's fake.
Well, I guess you'll have to wait and find out.
All right, okay.
But yes, the it's a fake is one that I think was a slow burn as an iconic moment. Like, I'd be curious to know how many sort of after the initial airing of that episode were like, oh, that's an instantly iconic moment for the franchise. But it's something that seems to have really gathered steam because I see people drop reference to that so much online now.
Well, I was around when it aired, and yeah. I think people...
Were you singing on the playground the next day?
No. I think I was like 15 when it aired.
What were you doing near the playground?
I was going to the monkey bars, talking to the kids. It's fake. No, I was not doing that, Cameron. So this is one where I think after it aired, though, like people were like, oh, that was an interesting delivery from that actor. I do think it did build up steam, but fairly quickly. Like, I think it had been like whatever the equivalent of like a meme was back in like late 90s within like a year or two of its airing.
Do you think it caught on more in syndication?
I don't
even before that.
I just don't think that DS9 really gained that much traction in syndication.
Right.
I think it was, and honestly, if you go to like a normie, they're not going to get this reference. These are hardcore fans here that are big into Senator Vrenak, obviously.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, why don't I touch on my In the Pale Moonlight moment
too?
Because I'm not just going to leave that thread dangling, you know, for the rest of the episode. It's Sisko facing the camera at the end and, you know, saying, you know, can I live with that? You know, yes, I can or whatever. It's that sitting there like isolated in that darkened room, staring forward at the camera.
A guilty conscience is a small price to pay for the safety of the Alpha Quadrant. So I will learn to live with it. Because I can live with it. I can live with it. Computer, erase that entire personal log.
No, but Cam, what sells it to me, though, is that he says, delete the log,
right,
and then it goes right to black.
Yes.
Flashes to black. Like that, yeah, very much.
But that single shot of Sisko sitting on that couch or whatever, staring forward at that camera, to me, when you show me that shot, that is an instantly iconic, you know, moment that, look, DS9, there's a lot of episodes. You can show me a shot of Sisko in a room, and I'm not going to be able to pick out the episode.
Sure.
You show me that shot, I can tell you the exact moment it happens.
Yeah.
And that's not an episode I've watched ad nauseum. I've seen it, I think, twice.
Well, You know, before you saw it, though, I mean, had that episode been built up to you beforehand?
Yes, by you.
Okay, but beyond me, was I the only one who was...
You were the only person that had ever talked to me about Deep Space Nine, to the best of my knowledge.
Oh, okay. Well, fair enough.
Yeah, so...
Okay, so I...
Especially, like, a decade after it was off the air.
Was it like more? 15 years.
Yeah, 15 years, yeah.
Did I build that episode up too much,
no.
in your opinion?
No, you didn't.
Yeah, because I still think, to this day, it's unlike any other Star Trek episode that's aired.
It is one of the greats. I mean, if you're looking at your top five Deep Space Nine episodes, I think that's one that's pretty safely on the list for people.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to go with another series here. You know, we can move around throughout all these different franchises here. But this one, I think we have to give it to one of the captains who has just, I think, one of the best deliveries for one of the best two-parters that's known out there. But Cam, let's see if you recognize this one here.
Torpedo launchers are down. I'm setting a collision course. Janeway to the fleet. Take your temporal shields offline.
Captain, we won't be protected.
Exactly. If that ship is destroyed, all of history might be restored. And this is one year I'd like to forget. Time's up.
Is that an iconic moment, Cam? Sorry, time's up, man. Too late.
Is it? I don't know.
Voyager crashing into Krenim's ship?
It's
The Krenim ship?
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty big moment.
Out of all the big moments from Year of Hell, what do you think is the most iconic?
That's probably it.
And out of all the two-parters, would you put Year of Hell as one of the most iconic among Voyager?
Yes.
So that's like...
I find Voyager very difficult to have big iconic moments from. I just don't know... maybe it's the quality of the episodes, because Voyager tends to hit good more so than great.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get a lot of iconic moments out of good episodes.
Well, let me say this. I'm not a fan of Year of Hell. Like, to me, right. It's just another example of Voyager hitting the giant...
I think I actually like it more than you do, maybe.
Yeah. But to me, it's another example of Voyager hitting the giant reset button.
Right.
But to me, I can't deny that moment of Voyager, like, smashing into Anorax's ship is very iconic,
though. Here's the question, though. Is it iconic because of what the moment was, or because it was designed to be iconic?
Oh, it was designed to be iconic.
Yeah.
Yeah. But let's say Mulgrew heard saying, time's up. Like, that's right. Just such John McCain, like, action hero.
John McCain?
Yeah.
McClane?
Sorry. John McCain. POW. Senator.
Sorry. Classic senator punchline.
Yeah. Yeah, during the presidential campaign.
He was like, time's up.
Time's up. Yeah. Anyway. No, but I think Mulgrew does it with the delivery there.
Yes.
I think a lot of people, if you bring up what was memorable about Year of Hell, people are going to reference Voyager crashing into the ship there.
I think you're right. It's not one that... when I think of iconic Star Trek moments, pops into my mind. But it's one I have, like, I'm not going to veto it, because I do agree. I mean, as we agree, it's designed to be iconic. And I think within the context of Voyager, it is. I don't know if I'm saying the larger world of Star Trek, that if you show me that clip, I'm like, yes, that is definitely Star Trek at its best.
Okay.
You know?
But I agree with you. I think it's more difficult to find iconic moments in, say, DS9, Enterprise, and Voyager, than, say, the films, the original series, and Next Generation.
Right.
What do you think that is, Cam? Is it because of how much those other things there, the other franchises, have penetrated pop culture, so it, by nature, kind of envelops us, or what?
I think that's a big part of it, because... the audience numbers for each of those successive shows dropped.
Yeah.
And so when we're looking at a lot of iconic, famous moments, they're the ones that people are throwing images up or doing fan tribute videos, all that stuff. The stuff that you just get bombarded with online, predominantly. You're seeing less Voyager Enterprise ones than we are of original series or Next Gen, especially.
Like, believe me, some of the other Voyager ones that I have on this list, it's like, they're iconic for Voyager.
Yes.
But a lot of people are like,
yeah, okay. I mean, if you go to a con and you're looking at all the Star Trek t-shirts, you're going to see a lot of shirts with images on things we're going to talk about in this episode. You're probably not going to see one with Janeway that says Time's Up.
I'm going to be making one and wearing it at the convention in Vegas in August. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, speaking of Time's Up, let me talk about another...
I want to keep talking.
I want to talk about an iconic moment from the original series that ties right into that theme. And that is the White Rabbit, the start of Shore Leave, and running by with his giant clock, and soon to be followed by Alice.
Oh, my paws and whiskers! I'll be late!
Now, this is a moment, it's goofy, it's silly, but it is a moment that is instantly memorable the second you see it, and you will never, ever, ever forget it. I've seen it on shirts, I see it everywhere. It's something that, I mean, to me, when I remember seeing the trailer for this episode, because I used to, when I watched the original series, I would watch an episode, then I would watch the, you know, the trailer for the upcoming episode, because I was always curious, what next adventure would I be embarking on? And I remember seeing the trailer and seeing that White Rabbit, and I could not wait to watch Shore Leave. Shore Leave is an episode that I like. I don't love fully, because I think it kind of wears out its welcome. But this rabbit moment is like
the never-ending fight scene between Kirk and Finnegan.
Yeah, and like the stock footage of planes. You know, yeah.
So you find the White Rabbit more iconic than Kirk fighting Finnegan for 20 minutes.
Yes, I do.
Okay. Maybe we can get into it a little bit, because before you assigned me to watch Shore Leave a couple years ago,
mm-hmm.
I actually wasn't even really aware of it.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So to say the White Rabbit is up there with, say, Tribbles falling on Kirk or Vina or slash Greena.
hashtag Greena.
Yeah. Excellent. I don't know if I can make that leap there. I can think
really?
Of so many more iconic moments in TOS off
oh,
the top
more,
of my head.
But that is...
But you think that's like top tier iconic moment from the original
I think it is up there, yeah. I think the White Rabbit is definitely up there.
If you went to a convention and said to a fan, 50 fans, name the 6 most iconic moments in TOS, do you think the White Rabbit would come up a lot?
I think it would come up.
Yeah, but a lot? I think there's just so many other moments in TOS that would come up before the White Rabbit.
Really?
Yeah, don't you?
I mean, yeah, there's definitely some on my list that would be on more so than the White Rabbit, but
right.
I do think the White Rabbit is a pretty big one.
Okay, Cam, if
we're really concerned, are we saving our vetoes to the end of the show? That might be the best idea, because I can already see your waiver in there.
Yeah, you know, you may come up with even bigger stinkers than this. So
I think the White Rabbit is a pretty strong candidate.
Okay, we don't have to veto anything, but
right.
It's just if we
the
so
option
decide,
is there. The option so I'm leaving, there. You know, yeah, I think we decide that at the end of the show, because I can already see your hand reaching for the veto button.
Okay, Cam. Well, you know, why don't we jump into the movies, though? I tackled it at the start, but I mean, I don't know how you beat this at all. And look, I want to say this. Just because it's an iconic moment doesn't mean it's a great moment, but
right.
What do you think about this one, sir?
Saddle up. Lock and load.
Cam, I that to me just epitomizes why I'm not a fan of Star Trek Insurrection, but that was all over the marketing, and you talk to any fan at a convention, you just say that, they know exactly what you're talking about. Is this an one of Star Trek's most iconic moments?
Here's the question. Is that the most iconic moment in Star Trek Insurrection?
There's a lot of iconic moments in there. Are any of them good moments? I think that like maybe the boob talk is up there.
Well, HMS Pinafore?
Yeah, that's up there as well.
I feel like Momboing Picard isn't as high on the list, even though it should be. It should be, to me, in my mind, it should be at the top of the list.
I would definitely put it in the top 5
of
iconic moments from Insurrection. But I do you think you're going to confuse anybody by going up to them at a convention saying, saddle up, lock and load?
This is an awful moment.
Whereas if you went up to some random at a convention and started talking about boobs firming up, do you think you could get in a little trouble?
At a Star Trek convention? Well, there's some social awkwardness. You might be able to get away with it. but
I think that might go over more people's heads than saddle up, lock, and load.
Yeah, I don't think it's a good idea either way.
Yeah.
But the saddle up, lock, and load is really... Oh boy, it's everything that was wrong with the 90s. Just, you know, look, the action movies of the 80s, and also James Bond more so really, introduced the whole sort of idea of these quips, having action heroes do these like kind of campy quips. Arnold Schwarzenegger movies in the 80s really pounded, you know, that nail hard, and I think Arnold was the perfect guy to deliver it. What really sucks is when you get into the 90s, and then a lot of filmmakers are like, we just got to give these to all these characters. And Arnold had a real skill at delivering these things that we would see that other, you know, Van Damme did not.
Yeah.
And I don't think Brent Spiner does either. I don't think he has the authority to pull off an idiotic line like that. Now, is it iconic? Yeah.
Yeah.
People know it. It was definitely hugely prominent in all the marketing and everything like that. And it makes no friggin' sense with a...
It's bad writing.
It's like, bad writing.
Out of all the interviews you've watched of Michael Piller...
Yeah.
Can you picture him behind his typewriter going, saddle up, lock and load?
Do you think this was his idea, or do you think this was maybe interference saying they want trailer moments?
It could have been like some script doctor that came in and inserted it in there. I just have a tough time picturing Michael Piller writing this.
This to me feels like a moment that maybe doesn't happen if they don't have that clip of Worf from First Contact saying, assimilate this in their commercials.
Do you even wonder if maybe assimilate this was from a script doctor?
It's possible.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that was Generation's big problem was they didn't have a big moment like that to sell in their trailers.
Yeah, that was its big problem.
That was it.
Okay. But
they needed Picard to have a wisecrack as he was crawling through that pile of rocks.
Oh, gosh. Well, okay. Do you think that there's any way that this line could have been delivered by Spiner, who we know is a great actor, that would not have been cringeworthy? Or is this just doomed from
this
the page?
This is bad. I mean, this line itself is just... It could work in a dumber action movie or something like that, but in a Star Trek movie, it just comes across as trying so hard. I can believe that, like, Worf might say assimilate this. Worf isn't always the brightest. Data, it's like,
what's he doing there?
Yeah.
What does that even mean?
Well, you don't lock and load a phaser rifle.
Yeah. You don't saddle up your shuttle.
Yeah, exactly. The whole thing is absurd.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if they'd made Data an expert in like 20th century pop culture like Tom Paris, then maybe I would buy it.
Yeah,
a little
I could
more.
Buy Tom Paris going around saying, saddle up, lock and load.
This seems like some, you know, maybe the fan of Captain Proton might say.
Yeah.
Or even Trip. If you had Trip say this, who's, you know, such a big fan of 20th century movies.
Yeah. But he'd have to say it in North Star.
Sure.
I'd buy it there.
I would buy that too.
Okay, Cam.
Well, let me do a TNG one because I haven't done any TNG and that feels wrong.
Yeah.
Let's just knock off an easy one because I feel like what's going to happen is we're going to be picking all the quirky ones and leave all the ones that people at home are thinking of out. So let's just talk about it because we have to. It's the I Am Locutus of Borg.
Yeah, that was on my list,
and
of
followed
course.
By Riker saying fire.
Obviously, yeah.
I am Locutus of Borg. Resistance is futile. Your life as it has been is over. From this time forward, you will service us. Mr. Worf, fire.
Is there a more iconic moment in the series, TNG? That's a good question, if you ask most people.
No, I think just the image of Locutus pointing his laser eye right directly at the view screen.
Yeah.
I think that... No argument. That is the most iconic moment of Star Trek The Next Generation. Yeah. Would you think that there's, not that you have to give it away, but do you think there's other moments that could be strong contenders?
Yeah, I think there's a couple,
okay.
But I don't think any of them have the fanfare behind them that Best of Both Worlds does. You and I have talked about Best of Both Worlds numerous times on this show.
Yeah.
And we've always very much appreciated it, but maybe it's not quite... It doesn't quite complete its transition into greatness that it deserves. Like in part two, it definitely kind of drops the ball a bit.
Yeah, and for listeners who haven't like listened to us discuss Best of Both Worlds before, you and I both think part one is a great Will Riker story.
Oh yeah,
And then part two, it's just, it's kind of a plot heavy slog.
It's kind of cleaning up what's left from part one. Yeah. And so while I don't think that two-parter is, you know, it's not probably in my top five TNG episodes, this moment is right up there.
So let me say this. I know the Locutus of Borg speech / introduction gets all the fanfare.
Yeah.
But the thing that just sends, you know, shivers up my spine, gives me goose pimples is when you cut to Riker and the camera's just panning around and he goes, fire.
Yeah.
Like, to me, that's Frakes at his best. I've never seen Frakes better.
Yeah, like, we talk a lot on the show about Frakes being fun. You don't have as many moments where you're like, Frakes is a total badass in this moment.
Yeah.
This is his best one.
Although, Kim, you did said you made a GIF, or no, I think you took like a little video from Star Trek Generations, and all it is you pointed this out. You can see Jonathan Frakes standing up in the background.
Yeah.
And he just looks so badass.
It's one of those moments that you know that he was putting a lot of thought into that rising out of the chair moment, and no one noticed it.
Yeah.
Because it's something that I didn't notice until I watched that movie for like, I don't know, the fifth or sixth time or something. And I had the commentary on when I noticed it, too.
Oh, okay.
It was actually, you know, not even listening to the actual dialogue in the movie.
For those who may not be fans of Star Trek Generations, listen to the commentary with Brandon Braga and Ron Moore. That's worth, you know, the price of the Blu-ray right there.
It is.
They do ridicule a lot of the movie, which I think is good.
Yeah.
But, okay. We got Locutus of Borg out of the way. I think we all knew that we're going to touch upon that one. So why don't I stick with TNG just a little bit as well, because here's the fact of the matter. Inner Lights, at the very end where Picard takes his little penny whistle and starts playing that melody again.
Yeah, that's on my list.
That does it for everybody.
That's
right?
One of the ones I was thinking of when you were saying what competes with Best of Both Worlds. I think that shot of Picard playing the flute is up there.
I think that's up there. I think that could, you know, well, I don't think anything's going to compete. But, okay, for the number two slot.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I think the Inner Light moment, you know, that could compete for sure.
And I think, you know, to me, Inner Light is a superior episode to Best of Both Worlds.
So, Kim, I was actually going through the Season 5 Blu-ray special features. You actually skipped the special feature, but they had the composers talking in a panel. So it's like Jay Chataway as well as Dennis McCarthy, Ron Jones. Mm-hmm. And the plan was, and I believe it was Dennis McCarthy that revealed this, but he came up with...
Picard is going to be playing an accordion?
No, it would have been Captain Picard's mandolin. That would have been amazing.
That would have been pretty great.
It's actually... he would not reveal who, but he said one of the producers wanted his son to compose the melody.
Okay.
And he said it was a kind of crappy melody. And this makes me think about... MASH, that it was actually the son of one of the producers that came up with the Suicide is Painless theme song.
Okay.
Whoever that, who was like 14 when he wrote that song.
Right.
That man is a very rich man after MASH went on for like 11 years.
No kidding. Those residuals must have been sweet.
Essentially, I think this is the plan for one of the producers is get his, pull a little nepotism, and then Dennis McCarthy was not having that. So he actually submitted two different melodies, and he said like one was crappy, and one was actually the good one there that we did get to listen to. So how would this have been an iconic moment the way that it is if not for... just the gravitas of the melody here. And I really do apologize if it was actually Jay Chataway, not Dennis McCarthy. But I think it was Dennis McCarthy that came up with this one. But how important do you think it is that this melody just is so fantastic?
I mean, this is one of those moments that I'm like, how did this happen? Because traditionally in TV, the music is not fantastic.
Yeah,
it tends to be a little bit cut rate and, you know, cranked out really quickly. The fact that they had this piece of music that is so instantly iconic and memorable and beautiful and haunting and all the great adjectives that you can possibly think of on a TV schedule, 26 episodes a season, is astonishing to me. Like, this is a miracle.
Yeah.
Because, this just doesn't happen. Especially not in, like, 1980s, 90s television.
I do wonder, like, what if that melody just is, like... I've been watching Seinfeld lately, and I just got to the episode where Elaine's in that hot and heavy relationship with the saxophonist.
Yeah.
And remember at the end, he just can't play the saxophone. Right. It's going. You know, like, what if, like, that's what Picard sounded like in his quarters at the end of the episode?
Or he just played hot cross buns.
Speaking of which, we do have fallen co-host Benjamin Yong. He did play a cover version of this on his recorder for our best musical moments.
I think that was like episode 10 of this podcast.
So if you guys want to go back about 120 episodes, then...
It's a good one, though. Like, it's a fun episode.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I agree 100% on the inclusion of that one.
You're not vetoing it?
I'm not vetoing
it's
that
no
one.
No white rabbit.
Let's get to a Voyager moment, though. This is going to be, I think, controversial with some people at home, maybe. I want to talk about the salamander babies.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. It's tough because I was hoping you weren't going to take that one, but of course, like, it is.
It is.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, like, I just feel like there's no way to argue that the salamanders, and not just the babies, I should say, the two salamanders.
Yes.
Were Janeway and Paris.
Everyone knows what you're talking about.
You show that shot of those salamanders, and people know it instantly, and it means a great deal to them.
Salamander babies, like, I remember watching it at the time, and that made me angry. Watching the babies like swim off and then they left them on the planet. I remember being angry. How can this not be iconic? Everybody refers to this as one of the worst episodes of Star Trek period. Even though, Cam, you and I, we've discussed this one in depth. We both agree this is actually like worth revisiting.
With
open mind, of course.
I'll also give a little inside baseball fact on this episode, too, in regards to the podcast. Every week, I do a blog entry where I'll, you know, pick an image that relates to something we discussed in the episode to kind of promote the episode. We got more clicks on posting links to that of using that photo for our, I think, WTF Moments episode than, like, any episode, like, before that and after for a long time. Like, that shot of those salamander people were clicking on.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, I should just use that for, like, every week. But, yeah, like, the salamander babies have been very good to us.
Have you seen anybody at any of the conventions dressed as salamanders?
Just you.
Just me, yeah. I'm glad that I can be such, you know, an original dude.
Yeah.
There. Okay. You should join me one of these years, then.
Well, you know, maybe. We'll see.
Wow. Totally salamander babies in there. I debated about this. This episode Threshold totally was going to make my list. I debated whether it was going to be the salamander babies or just that really weird looking photo of Tom as like his face was falling apart.
Right. Yeah.
I still think salamander babies takes it. If you're talking about iconic moments from Star Trek Voyager.
Right.
Okay, Cam. I want to go back to the movies just a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because how can we not talk about nuclear vessels? Nuclear vessels, Cam.
Excuse me, sir. Can you direct me to the naval base in Alameda? It's where they keep the nuclear vessels.
Where can you tell me where the nuclear vessels are?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's the moment you're picking from Star Trek IV?
There's a lot of icon. Believe me, this is not going to be the only Star Trek IV moment that we talk about as we go through iconic moments parts 1 through 17.
Right.
Okay. Is this going to be an iconic moment for you? Do people know?
I should say, like, on my list, I don't have a single checkoff moment. So, yeah, I think if
I guess I can check that off.
Who's doing the dad jokes now? You know what? I think it's in the name, you know, it's fair that we have iconic moments that represent the characters. And while this isn't one of my favorites, it's one that I have to acknowledge is iconic to that character and something people reference whenever they talk about checkoff. And was, you know, in the 2009 J.J. Abrams movie, I believe he referenced even, you know, he didn't say vessels. I don't think he said, you know, the Wictor. But that aspect of that character is something that people really picked up on and love. And I think, yeah, I mean, that moment in Star Trek IV, which I don't think had any impact on me when I watched it, you know, the first few times or whatever.
It's never made me laugh, but
no.
I know for a fact that, like, a lot of fans think it's hilarious.
Yeah.
And so I do think it is iconic, only for that.
People love it.
Yeah. I do feel bad for Nichelle Nichols, though. Like, if you watch that scene, she's like, okay, like, Walter Koenig is totally carrying it, and then, like, she's, like, we're getting back in the Leonard Nimoy direction sort of debate where, for new listeners, you and I, we had issues with, I guess, Leonard Nimoy's directing in Star Trek IV, which right. we don't think is all that great. But Nichelle Nichols looks lost in that scene. Like, she's not keeping up with whatever, you know, Koenig's doing. And it's just kind of, it's unfortunate there.
Yeah, it would have been more fun to have, you know, her kind of play off of him.
Yeah, yeah. But she doesn't even have a line, or maybe she does or something like that.
You know, that sort of really strong character interplay stuff doesn't really kick in the movies until you get to, like, the J.J. Abrams movies. As much as people don't like, certain people don't like those movies, there's a real strong sense of characters bouncing off each other in ways that was not as present in the original series and TNG movies. So, okay, well, you know what? I'll do a movie one, too. I think I got to do it because we have to. It's the famous Khan moment from Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan. I mean, it was referenced in a famous Seinfeld episode where, you know, George yells it. Isn't that the episode where, like, he has the keychain? Is that what it is?
I don't think it's the keychain episode.
It's not the keychain episode?
No.
Okay, well,
I think doesn't it have to do with something with his fiancée, Susan?
Maybe. I think it's the same season. It's right near that point.
Definitely not the episode where she dies.
No.
He doesn't care.
Yeah.
Spoiler.
But it's a totally iconic moment. Parodied to death.
Yeah.
I don't think people really understand the context of that moment.
No.
But, you know, that kind of Kirk is putting on an act to kind of fool Khan.
Yeah.
But now here's a question, because, you know, we've talked about how Nicholas Meyer is such a great director and how we think that's among the best directed the Star Trek movies. How many people who watch Star Trek II do you think understand the reasons behind that moment?
Very few.
Yeah, that's what I've always felt, too.
Do you think it's because...
Because Shatner's known to be kind of a ham, so they just assume that that's Shatner?
Yeah, but even if somebody's sitting down and watching it and seeing it all in context, I think a lot of people miss out on that, or because they see that scene play out, and then they don't do the math after they figure out that he was putting a con on con, essentially.
Right.
They just watch that scene and view it as if it's being played straight.
Right.
So, yeah, I think most people, as iconic as it is, they misinterpret that entire scene.
Right.
I've got a good story for this, which you already know.
Okay.
Yeah, I remember you and I were at the worst fan expo ever here in Vancouver just a few months back.
Yeah.
And there's that amazing hat that I wanted to get, and all it said was Khan on the hat. But the big problem was, like, it looked like Abraham Lincoln's, like, stovepipe hat. Like, it was supposed to be like a ball cap, but, like, it looked like it was like gonna go 3 feet above my head, so I had to throw it away. Or I just decided
throw,
not.
Yeah, I paid for it and then threw it in the garbage.
it was
Tyler's,
like,
a very rich man. He's bragging now.
Look, for it was $25. It was a great deal. It was a very well-made hat, and it was just like, and I would have loved to walk around my neighborhood wearing, like, a hat that just said Khan. Kim, do you have any stories, maybe Seattle-specific, about this con line here? No? Okay. Well, of course, you and I, we went down to Seattle back in October with some friends.
Okay. I know where you're going,
this big, giant Star Trek exhibit that was going on in the Emerald City, as they like to call it down there. And they have this booth that you could walk into, and actually, you get to do your own version of Khan! And they record it, and then they insert you into the scene.
Right.
Now, we've got a very memorable line reading from our friend Jesse Oquendo, who...
he nailed it. Home run.
Yeah. Don't leave improv class, Jesse.
Well, I did one of my own, and believe me, I won't be...
sharing it.
Moving into stardom anytime soon either.
Okay. Con scene gotta be here.
Yeah, that's obvious.
One of the other ones that I do need to mention here is you know, if we're talking about character moments, Sulu fencing.
Yeah.
Throwing that thing. Like,
that's on my
list. I think that's a top five moment among normies.
Stand. No father. No escape for you. You either leave this bois bloodied, or with my blood on your swords.
I mean, does Sulu have another iconic moment?
In the series?
I don't care. Series, movies, whatever.
I
would say, like, in Star
Don't
Trek,
Call Me Tiny?
That's the one I'm thinking of. Yeah. And maybe the helicopter scene?
Sure.
In Star Trek 4? Like, there's just, I mean, maybe you could say on the Excelsior in Star Trek VI.
My God.
That sounded almost Charlton Heston-like, too. It was sort of a blend of Sulu and Charlton Heston.
My God.
You blew it up. But
bastards.
But yeah, I mean, to me, this is such an obvious, and it's so strange that this hugely iconic Sulu moment happens like a short number of episodes into the original series, and then you never get like a huge Sulu moment ever again.
Yeah, you'd think, you know, like, hey, we can get this guy to do anything, like go topless, swinging a sword around. George Takei told us a story about how he told the producers he knew how to fence.
Yeah.
He had no idea what he was doing. He had to go to classes to teach himself how to do it. So
this is a classic one. And I mean, you know, I guess you could maybe say Sulu in Mirror Mirror hitting on Uhura on the bridge.
It's something, but I still don't think it's anywhere close to, him, fencing in the corridors of the starship.
No. Yeah. This one's indisputable. It's such a fantastic moment too. And it's so much fun. Speaking of moments that I think are indisputable, we have to hit it. The Gorn versus...
Yeah, you do.
The Kirk versus the Gorn fight.
Yeah.
Which, if you watch on screen, you're really not hitting anything.
No. That's true.
To me, this moment, I mean, does it get bigger? Like, when we talk about the original series, I was saying earlier when we talked about Trouble with Tribbles, and you were saying, is there any moment bigger? The Kirk versus Gorn fight is definitely up there.
It's there. I think it could give it a run for the money.
Especially there was that commercial, I think from last year or something, that again showed like older Kirk sitting with the Gorn, you know, and like, it's like they're still milking that, you know, because they know that people recognize that. And there's something like that's so beautiful about it where it's like the camp factor is off the charts.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same point, it's cool too.
Kim, you do have a Bobby Clark story, do you not? Of course, for those who don't know, Bobby Clark played Gorn.
I mean, Bobby Clark talked about shooting that scene and how they really had, you know, no direction. There was no practice really in advance, and it was kind of just like improvised, as you may be able to tell watching the show. And Bobby Clark just was like, yeah, it's one of the worst fights ever put to film. He was very disparaging of it in a very tongue-in-cheek sort of way. Like he doesn't hold it up as one of the great fights in TV history, although I would argue it might be.
Very memorable.
Very, very memorable.
You do have a photo that you took with Bobby Clark, him holding the Gorn head, if I recall correctly.
Holding the Gorn head. I'm holding the Gorn action figure. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm wearing a Gorn shirt. Yeah.
So, Cam, as we wrap this up, are there any iconic moments here that you want to take off of the ones that I gave you here? Anything that you think you should veto?
I don't think so. I think I'm going to be on board for all of these.
Okay. As we go, by the time we reach part 17, you may be using that veto power more frequently.
As soon as you said we're wrapping up, I'm like, look at my list. Like, oh my God, the ones I'm leaving off. I can imagine the fury on the other end this episode.
And that's what we want to reemphasize to listeners. We have so many to get through.
This is a work in progress.
Yeah. So if you feel we left something off,
don't hesitate to send it to us.
Yeah, don't hesitate to send it to us, but maybe don't fret either. We'll get to it within maybe 5 years, I think.
Yeah. But before we actually do kind of wrap up the entries, we should include one that came in from James Chesser, submitted his own. Let me just play that clip.
Hi, this is James from Aberdeen, Scotland. Twitter handle @DietPizza. My most iconic Star Trek moment is the facepalm that Captain Picard does in Deja Q. Maybe it wasn't iconic at the time, but since then it's taken on a world of its own, and even people who never seen Star Trek tend to use it these days. So, I'd say it's pretty iconic.
So, I mean, if we're talking about Star Trek moments that have made memes that have taken over the internet, don't know that you can argue with this moment from Deja Q.
I do have a magnet on my fridge displaying the facepalm.
Why do you think the Picard facepalm is the most popular of facepalms? Because Worf does it, Riker does it, Sisko does
it. It's Patrick Stewart. He's got it. Like, there are even, the women's march that was going on throughout the world, recently. There's people carrying signs of just Picard, you know, like with doing the facepalm, like right. to protest, you know, which I find exhilarating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that one's an automatic in.
Yeah.
But do you think after they had the Picard facepalm, they were telling other actors to do facepalms?
Really?
I don't know. Like, no, I'm not asking. Oh, okay. Stating that as a fact. I'm saying, do you think that was the case? Because it seems like such a weird gesture. Like, how often in other shows do you see characters really do that?
I can tell you I do it a lot in just day-to-day life.
I do it a lot during this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. Just when I hear things like the White Rabbit, I I make a facepalm.
Okay, so as we get to your vetoes,
if we're talking about a Hall of Fame, I got like we listed so many of these iconic TOS moments that I'm not ever going to dispute. But when you talk about the White Rabbit from Shore Leave, I'm sorry, man, it's not doing it for me. Like I never even knew of this before I even watched the episode. You know, like I'm somebody who does a Star Trek podcast.
Does it sway you at all knowing that the White Rabbit shows up again in the animated series?
God, non-canon. All right, so I will veto that.
Oh, that one's sorry. Sick. I hope we get angry mail over that.
Okay, I'm willing to listen. I mean, not to you, but like to listeners. Yeah.
Okay, well, I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Would you like to save the White Rabbit?
No one wants to save the White Rabbit.
Send us your...
Not even Johnny Depp.
Send us your email arguing for why the White Rabbit deserves to be there. Also, get on Twitter, #SaveTheWhiteRabbit.
If there's a cogent argument for saving the White Rabbit, I'm all ears. Maybe this... If somebody really wants to save the White Rabbit, do it, you know, for Cam.
Yes, do it for me. So. I have nothing in my life. I need the White Rabbit in this in this canon. So, okay, well, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Well, Cam, we're going to get romantic. It's going to be Valentine's Day coming up, so we are going to be discussing the best and worst romances of the week. I'm doing research already, and a surprising number of them actually work for me. I'm just like, oh, I buy this as a relationship, but Cam... Right. There's a whole lot that fall flat here.
And when you say that, we're talking about episodes where the romance lasts 1 week, one episode.
One episode.
It's not two episodes. It's not a two-parter. Nope. It's like one episode, 1 hour, you know, that's it.
Yes.
So.
It's about the average length of your relationships, okay?
Well, as of late, that would seem to be the case.
Anyway.
So you can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in Vito the White Rabbit. That's Madness, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's REPORTON. N is in nuclear vessels.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.